Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good day. Welcome to New Books in History, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Cotillo of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel, and today we are pleased and indeed honored to have with us Professor Holger Offlerbach. Professor Offlerbach is Professor of Modern European History at the University of Leeds. He is without a doubt one of the leading historians dealing with the subject of the Great War, and today we're discussing his newest book, On the Knife's Edge, How Germany Lost the First World War, published by Cambridge University Press. Welcome, Professor.
Welcome. Thank you very much.
Professor, what is the thesis of your book?
My book is a history on Germany during the First World War. We'll say the German society fighting the First World War and of the German war effort. And the leading question is to analyze what the German society wanted to achieve by fighting this war, which became always growing hardship for everybody. So one question is, was Germany fighting, for example, for a European hegemony? Or for what were they fighting? And the second issue is the war itself, the hardship it brought. The third issue is that the First World War was not lost for Germany basically from the beginning, which while some historians claim that the big question of the First World War is not that Germany lost, but the question is only how Germany could hold out for 4.5 years. And I claim that for a quite significant time, the First World War was a close-run thing and that the German leadership had to commit a lot of mistakes to lose it. And the history of how these mistakes were made is also one of the main arguments of my book.
Now, why did Graf von Schlieffen opt to change the operational plans of Graf von Moltke the Elder?
Well, Moltke's plans were defensive, so basically preparing the German Empire for a two-front war. And they were realistic, but it was also kind of unattractive. You know, if you plan for a continental war and you really don't know exactly how you can end that, and this is basically what Moltke did. He said, we prepare for a defensive two-front war, and how this ends remains kind of open because he said, we cannot bring a decisive blow. We cannot do that. We can only fight for basically keeping things in the balance, making limited blows, hoping that the enemy will compromise at some point. Schlieffen offered a riskier strategy and developed it into a concept to make also a modern war more feasible with a kind of flank attack coming from behind, overflanking the enemy, and making also a modern war with all the dangerous modern weaponry. I would say he created the idea that it may be doable and winnable, both. And he was kind of brilliant in his field, and for that reason he could create enthusiasm in the staff officers of the German general staff, who basically then created this war plan, which is linked with Schlieffen's name. And here we have to mention that there are some historians who say there was no Schlieffen plan in the sense, but I think we skip that for a moment.
Now, what were the tactical and operational assumptions did Graf von Schlieffen's plan of 1906, which was the final rendition of, in terms of his handiwork, make, which subsequently became very problematical, I should say, in practice?
Well, there was no final plan in 1906 because the war plans had to be revised constantly. And Schlieffen in 1906 was succeeded by the younger Moltke. And the younger Moltke had then to, or more precisely, the general staff had to revise the war plans practically on an annual basis, because a war plan was an extremely complicated product of, for example, supplying a multi-million man army, transporting them by railway to the German borders, assembly of entire armies at the borders, and organizing the supplies. And this in the pre-computer age meant that was a terrible amount of most detailed work to get all the railway transports organized. And so we had in 1906 the last, of course, Schlieffen was relieved from his office. Moltke the younger took over. And the German general staff planning continued. And until 1914, it was permanently revised. And but the basic idea, building the German stronghold in the West and try to bring a quick decision in the West, was not altered. Does that answer the question, more or less?
Yes, it does. Would it be true to say that you do not agree with Fritz Fischer's thesis that the German Reich bore major responsibility for the outbreak of the Great War, and instead you lean towards Sir Christopher Clark's thesis?
Okay, so that is now a very complex question. So Fritz Fischer said that Imperial Germany had a hegemonic plan and a plan of conquest. And he published in his book countless German designs for conquest and hegemony. But I don't think that was the driving force of Germany starting the First World War. It was more a diplomatic miscalculation. What Christopher Clark said will say, the powers sleepwalked into the war. Sounds a little bit like Lloyd George's slithering into the war, even if Christopher Clark said that this was a stupid word from Lloyd George, that nobody's slithered into the war. But I don't see exactly where the difference is. And both of them probably want to say that the powers and the diplomats and the politicians saw the risks and still were deciding for war in a very complex and hasty decision-making process in summer 1914. And if you put a pistol on my chest, You click the trigger and you ask, are you now more on the side of Fritz Fischer or on the side of Chris Clark? I would go for Chris Clark.
Why was the Emperor William II a problematical leader for the German Reich during the war?
Well, William II was not up to the task. So that is already the simple answer. The German constitution gave the emperor a decisive role in deciding between the military and the civilian leadership of the empire, and the civilian leadership did not have enough say over the military. So basically, they needed the emperor. And if the emperor was unable to fulfill this coordinating role, Germany was in trouble. And the emperor was not able, despite all the theatrical speeches which he gave and in which he presented himself as a kind of absolutist ruler of Germany, the emperor was not able to rule Germany or to coordinate German politics in a sufficient manner. And that led to chaos during the First World War. And I try in my book to be balanced, so I don't say that Wilhelm II always did terrible things, because occasionally the Kaiser even made some okay decisions or some reasonable decisions, and occasionally was completely off. And but in total, the Kaiser was inept.
Why do you believe that the First Battle of the Marne was not a major turning point in the war?
Well, that is now an evaluation of the existing literature on the topic. And I'm not alone with this assessment. For example, Martin van Krefeld, the historians Martin van Krefeld, or Hugh Strawn, or David Stevenson, and all of them are of the opinion that the German supply lines were hopelessly overstretched. So far that Hugh Strawn said, in logistical terms, the Schlieffen plan was nonsensical. So that German troops needed railways to transport their provisions. And the German armies who were in northern France were already very distant from the railway end stations and had to transport then the stuff from the railway by with lorries or horse-driven carriages to the armies. And there was a logical end to that. And we don't know exactly what would have happened had German troops not retreated voluntarily during the Marne battle. Maybe they even would have won this engagement, but the most likely outcome for them not retreating would have been that they run aground maybe 50, 60 kilometers more at the south, but because of logistical problems. And for that reason, I say that the Battle of the Marne was not the moment in which Germany gave away the victory in the First World War, because most likely the German troops would have run aground more at the south, but they would have run aground. And already in the moment in which the Marne battle took place in September 1914, troops at other parts of the front were already digging in. So, and does that answer the question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Thank you.
Why was the Second Battle of Tannenberg a major German victory, and why was Paul von Hindenburg regarded as the victor as opposed to Erich Ludendorff?
Okay, so you say the Second Battle of Tannenberg, this already links to the name of the battle, because the battle we are talking about in late August 1914 was not at Tannenberg, but it was named after Tannenberg, which was a medieval battle of the German knights, which the German knights lost in 1410. And they recalled it, Battle of Tannenberg, as a kind of belated revenge for that battle, which is, of course, a historical anachronism, but it was extremely good publicity for the battle itself, because Battle of Neidenburg, Ortelsburg, or something like that would have had not the same sound. So, but this is now the name. The problem was that the German army was in the west, and only one army was left in the east to protect German territories against the Russians, which moved forward much faster than expected, also because they were called in by the French to speed up. And to stop them, the Russians had basically two armies operating in eastern Prussia, and Hindenburg and Ludendorff, who were called to take over the command over the German army operating in eastern Prussia, came up with a kind of encircling plan. They encircled one of the two Russian armies, and the other army was unable to help because it was divided by some lakes. We'll say they used very professionally the particularities, the geographical particularities of eastern Prussia. The German defenders had then a splendid victory and destroyed a Russian army. And the point why Hindenburg was considered the savior of Germany was that the eastern Prussian population was indefinitely grateful, because there were already hundreds of thousands of people on the move. They were fleeing from the Russians. And that Hindenburg then was able to protect German territory against the preceding advancing Russians was considered to be a great relief and a turning point. And it was also the stunning victory which the German army could not achieve in the West.
Why was von Falkenhayn chosen to succeed Graf von Moltke the Younger as chief of the great general staff?
I did not get what is this Falkenhayn and Moltke? Why did he succeed? Okay, so why did he succeed? The crucial point was that Moltke was of bad health. Already during the July crisis, during the first part of the July crisis, Moltke was on leave for health reasons. He was in Karlsbad. He was a sick man, and he was also a very nervous person. And when things did not move according to plan in mid-September 1914, it looked as if Moltke cannot do it. So basically, there was a moment of crisis. There was a Marne battle. Moltke was overly nervous. And the person who had to decide over replacing the chief of staff was the emperor, who could nominate and dismiss the chief of staff and the chancellor and so on. This was also all the emperor's task. And the emperor was aided in this decision-making process by his military cabinet. And the head of the military cabinet was General von Lünker. And they had already looked in early August for a potential replacement in case that Moltke the Younger would not be able to do it. And they came up with Falkenhayn, because Falkenhayn was by then Prussian Minister of War. He was in the headquarters. He was familiar with the task because he was available and already in the German headquarters, and he was considered to be an extremely energetic commander. So they thought that probably Falkenhayn would be the best replacement in case that Moltke cannot do it. And in mid-September, it was definitely Falkenhayn's moment. And Wilhelm II also thought that Falkenhayn was one of the best generals of the German army, and he was deeply impressed by the person because Falkenhayn was a very elegant appearance and could also give excellent presentations. So he was obviously outperforming in, for example, planning the strategic situation and could always impress the emperor with his detailed knowledge of military affairs.
As a biographer of Falkenhayn, do you believe in retrospect that the decision was a correct one?
Well, I am Falkenhayn's biographer, but not a hagiographical one. So I'm not saying that Falkenhayn was a second Napoleon or something like that. I have anyway difficulties to see a second Napoleon in the First World War. I see generals who may be better than others, but not this kind of brilliant commander. And Falkenhayn made too many mistakes in due course. Then I could claim that he was a brilliant commander, because somebody who started the Battle of Verdun and who wanted to start the unlimited submarine warfare. Sorry, I cannot tell you this was a brilliant choice. We can say that Germany would have needed a commander with definitely more strategic wisdom. Falkenhayn had his merits, so he was not a complete failure, not at all. He had also a kind of view of strategic balance, and he had his merits, and he did also a lot of good strategic moves. But overall, somebody would have been needed with wider views. And the question is who? Because the problem, we had Moltke the Younger, who was sick. We had Falkenhayn, his successor, and later Falkenhayn was replaced by Hindenburg and Ludendorff, and this was definitely a fatal choice. These two, definitely not. But I know because of my research, I know the German leadership of the First World War quite well. And if you were asking, was there another candidate who had the abilities to bring that war to a better conclusion, that would be very, very difficult. Because you see a lot of able generals, but none of them who is really, really a kind of brilliant mind who understands, as we can say with hindsight, German strategic necessities. Probably the best of the crowd would have been Wilhelm Gröner, but he was far too junior by then.
Why did Falkenhayn decide to make Verdun the centerpiece of his attritional strategy in 1916, and why did it not succeed?
You mean why did he attack in 16 and not 15?
Well, why did he make Verdun the centerpiece of his attritional strategy? And why did it not work?
The point was, if we go through the First World War, and in 1915, Falkenhayn was able to stabilize the German situation. So there was a two-front war, similarly as it was planned from Moltke the Elder, and Germany was able to hold its ground on both fronts, on the east and on the west, but it was not able to make a decisive blow, despite the fact that many generals still thought Germany could do it. And this is one of Falkenhayn's merits, that he was very realistic about that. And he said, Germany is not strong enough to deliver a decisive blow. We cannot do it. So he stuck with that, but he was able to stabilize the fronts in the West in 1915. The Western Allies were attacking, but without success and big losses. And in the East, the Germans and the Austro-Hungarians were able to defeat the Russians so that the Russians had to give up Russian Poland and looked as if they were pretty much knocked out for the rest of the war. Still, you know, still fighting, but losing a lot of their fighting power. And Falkenhayn thought, because he always pressed also for political solutions of the war, which was another benefit of this commander, another merit, that he pressed for political solutions and said, we have to try to find a political way out. But there was no political way out because German diplomacy was not able to deliver. It was also a hard call. Because the enemy was not ready to negotiate. The Germans made, for example, a lot of peace offers to Tsarist Russia, but Tsarist Russia refused. So basically, Falkenhayn was then in the unenviable position that he had to end a war, despite the fact that he himself had said, we don't have the means to end the war with military power, because our military power is not sufficient to create a victory over all of our enemies. But still, he had to try. And for that reason, I call this chapter in my book Squaring the Circle, basically something impossible. He was in front of a possible strategic task. If you know you don't have the force to achieve victory, but still achieving victory is the only way out, you are at a loss. And so he came up with this idea to attack Verdun. And in my opinion, Verdun was an attempt to use the particularities of trench warfare to end of the particularities of the place of Verdun, to create a situation where the French would be forced to attack in French warfare and the Germans were in the role of defenders and could create enormous losses for the French. And this was supposed to work that way, that he wanted to conquer the East Bank in front of Verdun, a series of hills, post artillery in front of Verdun, shoot into the city, and forcing the French or to give up the city or to start a counter-offensive. And this counter-offensive would have been for the French an uphill battle. We'll say something coastally. Falkenhayn wanted to force the French to sustain enormous losses and to come to the point that they have to compromise. And he hoped in this complicated planning that maybe the British will have to attack on the Western Front as well to help the French once the French are in trouble because of their efforts in Verdun. The reason that it did not work was that to make this mechanism work, Germany needed these hills in front of the city. And Falkenhayn did not give enough forces to this attack to conquer the hills, and they conquered only half of the hills. And then they tried to repair the mistake, and it was immediately a strategic quagmire and complete disaster, because then German and French troops were fighting under terrible conditions, and both of them had more or less the same losses. But Falkenhayn overestimated the French losses throughout his tenure and thought that the French may at the end of the day be still significantly weakened, even if Germany had to pay a much higher price than he originally thought they had to pay. And that was, in my eyes, the reason for the attack of Verdun, and also the reason why it backfired and became this battle of attrition, which we know.
How important an influence on German strategy was the so-called turnip winter of 1916-1917?
Well, the turnip winter was of utmost importance. The turnip winter was caused by a poor harvest. So in Germany, foodstuff had to be rationed during the First World War, increasingly rationed, and there was anywhere a downward spiral. But until spring 1916, the food situation in Germany was good enough, not brilliant, but good enough. The poor harvest of 1916 led to increasing shortages, and the calories which you get on the official ration card went in the winter below 1,000 calories a day, and so definitely not sufficient. And that brought in Germany kind of outburst of despair, that because there were two contradicting elements in the war. The first one is you have this massive home front issue that you don't know anymore how to supply enough food to your starving population and to the army. On the other hand, military situation was quite brilliant, because in 1916, the Allied powers had attacked on all fronts, on the Somme. The British and the French had attacked on the Somme. The Russians had attacked against the Austro-Hungarians, made the Brusilov offensive. The Italians had attacked at the Isonzo, the Romanians had entered the war, and still the Central Powers were able to stop all these attacks and to stabilize the fronts and even to conquer Romania and or the biggest part of Romania. So militarily, they were in a quite brilliant position. But they said, where's the point? If we have at the end to surrender because our internal situation is so fragile because of the question of nutrition, we need a quick end to the war. And this time pressure, which was created by the internal situation, led to the most dramatic strategic mistake of Germany during the First World War, which was a decision of unlimited warfare, submarine warfare against against Britain, in the hope to be able to force the British out of the war within 6 months, but in reality bringing the Americans in. And Winston Churchill had made the claim that Germany or the First World War, there were 6 weeks between victory and defeat, because German declaration of unlimited submarine warfare started on the 1st of February 1917. And if they had waited until mid-March 1917, the first Russian Revolution had started. The Tsar had to abdicate, and it looked increasingly as if Russia will collapse. And with the collapse of Russia and the Americans not in, the First World War would have been, as far as we can say, would have been a draw.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Following from that, so you would say in effect that the decision to go ahead with unrestricted submarine warfare was a case of a policy of va-banque.
Yes, it was caused by despair. It was caused by the Navy promising. It was kind of very complicated calculation. So that is another thing in my book that I try to show, that intelligent people can make idiotic decisions. So it's very easy to say Imperial German leadership was idiotic to make the submarine warfare, and every cab driver would tell you that. So basically, you don't need a particular insight to say the decision was idiotic and had disastrous consequences for Germany. But the task is to look how, if you consider that these people may not be completely incompetent, if you think they are all idiots, it's easy to explain. If you think these people were reasonably competent, why did they do it? And then you see the sheer despair on the one hand, which puts enormous pressure on the decision maker, the sheer public despair about the food situation. And then you have the Navy. The Navy is the Navy leadership is under enormous pressure from their underlings, activists who say that the Navy has to contribute something to the struggle of the fatherland and so on. And they came up with an elaborated plan. This elaborated plan was that they had called in civilian specialists, for example, grain traders, who had a lot of knowledge about grain trade and international shipping and so on. And they calculated how big is a British merchant navy and how much of this merchant navy is needed for war purposes to transport and troops and supplies, and how big is a navy is a merchant navy to supply Britain, and how much can we sink if we go over to unlimited submarine warfare. And then, because there was also a poor harvest in Britain and they have to import grains from overseas, from Argentina, from Australia and so on, so they need much more shipping than normal. And then it looked as if there is a kind of opportunity to destroy British logistics, to sink enough ships so that Britain cannot anymore supply its population, so that Britain has to compromise politically. So basically that was a calculation, and they came up with it, and it looked as if it is kind of, it looks very professional if you see it. So there were people making mistakes who still were experts in their field. And this makes it more explainable, even if there were also in the time many people who said it is a terrible mistake and stood with it. Bethmann Hollweg, the chancellor, was of the opinion that it was a mistake. His deputy, Karl Helferich, was of the opinion that it was a mistake. Max Weber, as a public intellectual, was of the opinion that it was a terrible mistake. And we had also in the time many people who said it is a mistake and it remains a mistake. But the reasons why the mistake was made can be explained.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Professor, but I don't believe you employ in the book the term the silent dictatorship. If that is the case, why don't you do so?
So you mean the silent dictatorship, Martin Kitchen's book. And I don't use it, indeed. You're right. I'm not, or maybe I, of course, I know the book, and it has also its merits. The point is that I have in my book, I explain how the decision-making process in Imperial Germany worked. And the decision-making process of Imperial Germany was, you know, if you think that Imperial Germany was a kind of imperialistic machine who wanted to conquer Europe And then you have this kind of idea that there's a kind of hierarchical structure, and all the Kaiser or Hindenburg and Ludendorff, the silent dictators, are basically in command and deciding what to do. And instead of that, I use the explanatory model by Hans-Ulrich Wehler, German social historian, who speaks about Imperial Germany being led by power centers, by competing power centers. We'll say the emperor and the court, the general staff, the navy, the parliament, the Reich Chancellor, and the Foreign Office. And these poles were kind of competing in the decision-making process. And even in a situation where the military had the upper hand, because they said, we don't know a way out except military victory, then, of course, the military has always a kind of preponderance because they have to deliver it. But still, I think silent dictatorship goes too far, to use this term. And I have very good sources to support me, because Ludendorff himself denied that he is a dictator. He denied that to his surroundings by the military who pushed him. He denied that to Walter Rathenau, for example. And he always said that people are vastly overestimating his influence also, and also his possibilities. And I agree with him in this point, despite the fact that I don't deny that Hindenburg and Ludendorff had very great influence. But having very great influence does not mean that I am a dictator.
Why did Ludendorff gamble on a decisive victory on the Western Front in the spring of 1918, and were there any plausible alternatives?
Good question. The point is that in late 1917 and early 1918, the strategic situation for Germany looked pretty good. And the following things had happened. The first one, the Second Russian Revolution had taken place. Lenin came to power in Russia, and he started his time in government with starting immediately peace negotiations with the Central Powers, and they took place in Brest-Litovsk. So basically, the Eastern Front, there was still an Eastern Front, but there was an armistice, and the military situation looked much better for Germany. Romania also asked for an armistice. This was the second military good news. The third one, a major victory against Italy at Caporetto in autumn 1917, so that the Italians looked very close to collapse. And but still, the question was how to continue now the war, how to bring that to an end. And there was a certain tendency to think in the German society that, to believe in German military superiority, and to think that now, after defeating the Russians and after defeating the Italians, something like that may also be possible in the West now, that Germany could really focus its entire military strength on the West. There were many people believing it, and they were underestimating the extreme difficulty of winning on the Western Front, which is also proven by the fact that in 1915, 16, 17, the Western Allies had tried attacks on the Western Front and they had failed, because on the Western Front you did not have the sufficient superiority to be able to manage a breakthrough. And the alternative would have been to try or to try peace negotiations, and they tried. And also in January 1918, there were the speeches by Lord George and also Woodrow Wilson with the 14 points. And the German leadership even tried somehow, albeit lukewarm, to embark on Wilson's 14 points by then. But it led nowhere because Wilson stopped any public conversation about that. And they also invited the Western powers to participate in the peace conference in Brest-Litovsk. And the Western powers did not show up, of course. And so it seemed that the enemy is uncompromising, and the best way for generating a quick peace would be military victory. And in early 1918, this was a widely held assumption in Germany and also Austria-Hungary. So basically two points. The first one, the enemy is uncompromising. The second one, military victory is possible. And then if you put that together, you have a certain tendency to try it in the West. And Ludendorff embarked on that, and he was not alone in believing it. And he had even serious strong doubts. And for that reason, he had designed this attack as a kind of sequence of offensives. So basically making one big blow, and if it does not get through, preparing a second and a third and a fourth and a fifth, all that was already factored in. And this was what happened in 1918. He delivered one blow after the next, making the German army always weaker. And at the end, in July 1918, the German army was so weakened that then the Allies could start a counteroffensive, and the German army by then was not anymore able to stop that.
In literature dealing with the Allies' side of the Great War, there is in the year 17, and particularly 1918, a great deal of reference to the so-called learning curve thesis, particularly in the so-called 100 days at the end of the war. Is there a similar variable in the case of the German army during the Great War?
Yeah. So I know the learning curve thesis is a beloved topic among British military historians, especially in Birmingham. And they love to show that the British army became good and better during the First World War. And in 1918, they exceeded the German master, so to say. So the Germans, the best at the beginning of the war, and then the learning curve, and the British became the best. And in my eyes, I see it slightly differently, because I think that there was a learning curve on all sides, as well as wear. You know, war does not make an army automatically better. It makes it worse normally. And there was wear and on all sides, and there were also improvements, tactical improvements, better equipment, better tactics. They were also on the German army. They made a lot of improvements to an extent that Ludendorff's manual for the Western Offensive for 1918 was then copied word by word by the Americans. And at the end, when the Americans in September 1918 started their own attacks, they used German translated manuals. So there was a learning curve on all sides. But what really made a difference is that the Americans sent a multi-million army to France in 1918. And I don't think the 100 days would have been possible without 2 million American troops being in northern France. that would have was a difference, because if the Americans had not been there and the 1918 events would have been a fight between the Germans on the one hand and the British and the French on the other hand, it would have ended undecisively with a complete exhaustion of all sides. But that on the western side there were 2 million fresh troops made the difference. And for that reason, I see the learning curve as an argument. It must be surrounded by all these other arguments, because taken alone, it does not make sense.
Why did Ludendorff push for an immediate armistice in September 1918?
Well, the immediate armistice was caused by the German army. Basically, in mid-July, there were Allied counterattacks, Villers-Cotterêts, for example, and then the Black Day of the German army in August. And then they always thought, Hindenburg and Ludendorff thought, that they can slowly retreat into the Hindenburg line, and the Hindenburg line was a formidable obstacle, and to stabilize the front in the Hindenburg line. What happened was that the Hindenburg line was pierced. So the Western Allies were able to break through the Hindenburg line, which was already a sign of decreasing German morale and fighting power, because military experts were of the opinion that the Hindenburg line was so strong that if the defenders were as motivated as they had been in 1917, it would have been probably impossible to break through. So the first thing that. And the second thing, Germany had weakened all other fronts to bring troops to the west to stabilize the fronts, and they had very much weakened the front in Bulgaria. So there was an Allied bridgehead in Saloniki, and there was a strong army, a multinational army, and the Bulgarians had warned that half a division is not enough German assistance and they needed more. And the German general staff said, we don't have more. And when then Allied attack started in Saloniki, they could break through the Bulgarian lines and the Bulgarians surrendered. And both events came at the same time. So the Bulgarians surrender on the one hand, and the piercing of the Hindenburg line in the west. And in this moment, it became pretty clear that the game is up, because the surrendering of Bulgaria meant that that the Central Powers lost a 500,000 man army, point one. Point two, that the Armée de l'Orient, we'll say the international army in Saloniki, was free to move all over the Balkan to cut off the Ottoman Empire, so that the Ottoman Empire, who had suffered defeats anywhere in Syria, probably would surrender next, and that Austria-Hungary would be threatened, and that probably Romania would resume hostilities. And also the German army in the west was not knowing how to stop the enemy once it broke through the Hindenburg line. And so basically everything was coming together, and then Ludendorff wisely said, the game is up, and we need an armistice now, and the sooner the better. And he wanted an armistice which promised to give up, for example, the enemy territories which were occupied by the Germans and the German troops retreating to the German borders. And when he understood that in the armistice negotiations, the Allied wanted to achieve much more, something on the level which was basically indistinguishable from a normal surrender, then he wanted to resume fighting, but by then it was too late.
Professor, if you wanted people to take one thing away from your book, what would it be?
Well, There is a British politician whose name is Lord Lansdowne. And Lord Lansdowne said in a famous peace letter, which was published in autumn 1917, that it was necessary for the survival of Europe to try to find a political end to the war. And basically, he suggested negotiating with the enemy. And he said that the wanton prolongation of a war is a crime differing only in degrees from the crime to start it. And this idea that only victory is a way to stop such a war is an extremely costly idea, which may things worse than trying to find a compromise. And I don't say this would have been a better world, because I don't know and I cannot offer an alternative history. But what I can do is to ask the questions. Do we have to fight until victory in such a war, or in wars in general? And does it really bring an advantage for victors and vanquished likewise? Because also the victors don't get out of the war, of the victory, what they hope they should get out of it. So that I call victory a kind of chimerical concept which creates illusions which it cannot deliver upon.
On that observation, I would like to thank you very much, Professor, for being so kind as to speak with us today. You've been listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Thank you, Professor, very much.
Thank you.